Hey, this is Anthony, and I'm the host of What They Did Not Teach You in School, the podcast that interviews people to get their wisdom recorded so that hopefully you could learn some things that are not taught in school, but should be taught in school. I'd like to remind people that a lot of the things talked about on this podcast relate to investing and finance. The purpose of talking about these subjects are to hopefully inform people and educate them on financial literacy, and to entertain people with some do's and do nots. This is not to be considered financial advice. Before trying anything that you learn on the podcast, be sure to consult a professional. Hello, 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 and welcome to this week's episode of What They Didn't Teach You in School. I'm very interested in having this particular guest on the podcast today for our 46th episode.
How often do you do them?
Well, I've been doing it for 5 years.
Yeah.
But in the last 2 years, we've been doing a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
So once a month, I'd say.
Once a month, yeah, cool.
Yeah. And we're really ramping it up now because we have the studio and more resources to allocate for. Because it's always been like I'm the bottleneck for launching these episodes. Time, yeah. But now that I got Valentina, producer extraordinaire.
Valentina is her own brand right here.
She is literally her own brand. Yeah. It's been a lot easier. So anyway, I have Philip Miller on the podcast today. We met at a dinner about a month ago where I went. It was hosted by Hyla from 437. How did you get invited to that? Do you know Hyla?
Anthony.
Anthony. Yeah, that's right. Okay, cool. And
the artist.
Yeah, he's great. Actually, we have some art up in the podcast studio from him that night.
Amazing.
And I met you, and you had such a fresh take on the world, both because you're a lawyer, but also because of your experience in like the army that I think is just so unique. Also, your intellect and the way that you speak, it's very like eloquent. And we had some great conversations multiple times throughout the night. And I'm like, I gotta have this guy on the podcast because we were talking about. These are the things that we were talking about were the things that are not taught in school.
Yeah.
So that's what made me very excited, particularly for this episode.
Yes. Once I heard you had this podcast, I was like, okay, I got to tell you why I dropped out of an executive MBA because of how garbage it was.
I can't wait to get into that. And just so people, you have a podcast yourself. Tell us a little bit about that. Where can people find you online?
You know, I kind of started, I also have a marketing company and a law firm. And I've had a wide range of experience. So I think I was one of the first lawyers in Canada to start talking about things online. Not necessarily in podcast form, but just in terms of creating short reels discussing controversial topics. And we've been trying to build this podcast for a long time. But like you, when you have multiple businesses and national level trials, you kind of deprioritize it. But we've been trying to focus back on it because there's an appetite to hear conversations that matter.
Yeah, and that's actually something that I respect about you is that most lawyers, probably because of like compliance or political issues or their own comfort, are more conservative in nature and wouldn't talk about the things that you speak about on your channel. What makes you different or what kind of... You weren't always like that, were you?
Well, you know, getting into the background in terms of... you know, I used to be a combat officer. And, you know, when you've been shot at and blown up and carried your buddies wounded or dying and seen people killed, you tend to, I think if you channel that experience in a healthy way, some people are really poorly affected by it. You just feel thankful to be alive. And so you don't really care if people like you anymore. You just, but the thing about law, and if you have any listeners who are looking at law, I hear way too many lawyers position themselves as A-types. But they think that means alpha. And it's very different. Alpha is a leader who takes risks, who puts themselves out there. A lot of the men that I've seen that gravitate towards law, they're not risk takers. They're very smart. They want to have luxury. They want to get rewarded for their hard work, and they're amazing at it. But they will not put themselves at risk. And essentially, their whole industry is telling their clients how not to do anything risky. But you can't lead or change the world unless you have a high risk tolerance. So you need to know how to bet big and how to be right. And from my perspective, like, I don't care if lawyers like me or not. I care if my clients like me, whether it's my legal clients or my business consulting clients. But I don't care if others like me because they're not doing anything interesting.
I, c-
couldn't agree more, especially in today's world. A lot of people are afraid of getting canceled or like pushing the envelope on things. So it's like people that will like you for your opinions and like pushing that envelope will like you, and the people that won't. But the people that do like you will like you a lot.
Yeah.
And that's a good balance.
I think you'll like this quote. I had an occasion to work for a couple of weeks with Colin Powell, the former U.S. general, who just was an inspiring human being to me. And he had said, you know, good leadership means pissing people off, because mediocre people want to stay in their comfort zone. And if you're actually doing something that matters, you're going to have to tell them it's not good enough. And then they'll call you arrogant for demanding that they do more.
Yeah, I think the first realization for me in regards to that was when, like, when I was growing up, it was like the Obama administration when I was growing up. And like, he was like one of the ones to just like first use social media and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I would go look at his Instagram profile and I'd look at the comments section. People were like despising this guy. Mm-hmm. I'm just like, oh my gosh, like people either loved him or hated him completely. And that was like a realization to me to be like, if I'm ever going to do something great, there's going to be haters. And I think it's a natural inkling for human beings, or especially like younger people, to want to like be liked by everybody, maybe because of like high school culture or whatever. And that was a paradigm shift for me.
It's interesting for your listeners, because if you're in a corporate or a government world, you have been trained to be compliant and obedient, which means say what the masses tell you have to say. So it's hard for you to show any type of personality or even do anything great, because what we have is a decade of where we've moved people up the levels of leadership in corporations and government who just are compliant and obedient. So if you dare to say something controversial, you'll get hammered in a corporate world. So I'm not telling somebody who's middle management in a corporation to all of a sudden go be bold. But if you're an entrepreneur, or if you're trying to build something, don't mimic what corporate people do, which is virtue signaling, obedience, compliance. It's just garbage. But if you want to do something great as a person or as a company that you're in charge of, you have to take risks.
I love this. So just for our listeners, real quick, if you could do it in, it's difficult to summarize a life, but if you can in a short period of time, tell us a little bit about your background and what has led you to be where you are right now.
Let me see if I can do it in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
9 years old, started shoveling neighbors' driveways. 14 years old, built a landscaping company. Father was fairly successful prior to going to university. Father lost his job from an investor who stole all the money.
Shit.
So went kind of riches to rags. Went to Western, worked full time to get through a poli sci degree, became a hippie, saw a couple of Grateful Dead concerts, smoked some, but I never kind of fit into one box, but I was always an athlete growing up and always an entrepreneur. Somebody dared me to try a military course, said I couldn't do it. I went there, cut all my hair off. They almost kicked me out the first 2 weeks for being a rebel, ended up graduating top of 72 students, only 24 made it to the end. I was a top student. So I think sometimes the best people in fields are the ones who are kind of reluctantly in there. Like the best police officers aren't always the ones who just always wanted to like arrest somebody. It's that person who can understand. What I loved about the military was the idea of strategy and tactics. And so I just studied everything there was about how to win when you're facing an opponent who wants to kill you. Was an infantry officer, became an airborne officer, charge of recce platoon, pathfinder platoon, Canada snipers, worked with special forces teams across the world in England, US and Canada, and eventually lost my eyesight and then had to reclassify to law. So I'm blind in my right eye.
Wow.
And in that reclassification, I was on a tour overseas and my eyesight didn't work after a couple of incidents over there. And then I wanted to stay. I was going to be a military lawyer and be like the lawyer to the generals that would help give advice as to, is it legal to do this or how do we do that? But the military, in their wisdom, after paying me full salary to go to law school, decided I had to be medically released. So I went into the Crown Attorney's office, was convicting people, I think too easily because their lawyers sucked. And I wasn't getting a lot of joy from that. And plus it was my first view in the military. It's very egalitarian, even though people want to think. In the military, you don't care really who's sleeping with who, where people are from. You know, you just care if they'll cover your back when shots are coming downrange. we call it, you know, true equality when you're at the two-way rifle range, when you're not just shooting one way, but when they're shooting back, you just care about the content of the character of the human there. And I love that brotherhood and sisterhood of no BS victimhood. It was just people who would die for you. Mm-hmm. And they weren't necessarily polite, but God damn it, did they care about you and your family. That formed something in me while I continued to consume as much information as I could about strategy and winning and leadership. I ended up running a leadership school for a while. And then when I moved into law, I was just shocked by how dysfunctional civilian society was, with scarcity mindset of people who pretended to be your friend, but were so intent on personal success, they had no ability to understand group goals. Or sacrifice for something other than their own ego. And so I tried to help people in law school get that. But it was rigged because the big companies funded law school and they made you on day one feel like if you didn't get a job that first summer, you were a loser.
Right, right. Yeah.
And I think that's what creates a lot of dysfunction in law. And then so I wanted to change law, got into the Crown's office. Didn't like it because as a bureaucracy, you know, you weren't rewarded based on merit, which I can't stand. On things that aren't merit-based. So I ended up going to a big firm, then hated the big firm environment where it was all about egos, and eventually started my own firm and then started a consulting company. And here I am today.
Wow. And what made you get into marketing after that?
Well, when I was in the military, I did psychological operations training, information warfare training, lots of strategy training. And to me, these are all like really functional courses and training in marketing.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it's, I used to tell my, my ex-wife, who's a wonderful teacher, but she's a great teacher, not because of teacher's college. Cause when I watched her go through teacher's college, it was garbage. You know, the instruction I got in the military on teaching was way better. And I used to share what we got. And I find the same in school. Like, I don't know what marketing schools really teach these days, but I know studying human behavior, strategy and messaging was exceptionally relevant. And then I had to get to a point. My partner, Camille, was saying, you should be in marketing. And I invested in the company that we built. But I think part of me wanted to stay in law because I thought it was more prestigious.
Right.
Yeah. Even though I really enjoy marketing 100 times more and helping people and not dealing with dysfunctional adversarial humans. You know, like it's what you deal with in law.
Yeah.
But so it was just a natural progression to where I am in my life now, where I can bring the range of experience to bear with companies and help them.
I can relate a lot to the things that you said there, particularly like when I was growing up in university, I was like hippie, I suppose, as well. And I was just like, I don't understand war. Like, what's the point of like armies and war? Like, wouldn't it be better if just like there were no armies? But then a friend of mine, he went to the army and he started telling me a lot about it. And I actually became so fascinated by it. Like it's such, from a Canadian perspective, such a, like the army is so big and multifaceted and multiple departments and well organized. It's like a machine, maybe not as well organized as you think it could be, from such a large organization, I was awed by it. And then also like the strategy and tactics of like inter-conflict amongst countries, I found very interesting as well during that period of time of like learning about it, although I've never been in the army before. And then I started like learning more about it and like the psychology behind it and like the politics. I thought it was very interesting, which is why I was excited to have you on here. But also the most important thing is the merit-based versus seniority-based kind of environments. I always grew up in more of a merit-based environment, like sport, and then I was in banking, and then I brought that over to like marketing. So I really enjoy that kind of environment. So it's great to hear someone else have like such a fresh perspective on that.
It's healthy. We were talking about this, I think, earlier this week on how you get something done, because one of our clients is kind of a union. I would say it's a union, but for high pay individuals, and how dysfunctional committee-based leadership is. Like literally there's a committee for everything. Mm-hmm. Everybody's opinion matters. And essentially it moves at the pace of molasses, where in the military, you still have to care about your subordinates, but you need a little bit of hierarchy. And what the military is great at doing is huge things quickly. right? And it's fun when you like you come out of a place where you could get stuff done because people focused on the mission before themselves. And so you could move 5,000 people across the ocean in 2 weeks, you know, whereas in many of these organizations, you couldn't even get a memo done in 2 weeks.
Right, exactly.
So there is room for hierarchy, you know, and group goals over personal goals.
What kind of advice would you have for like young Canadians trying to think about, should I go into the military? Is that right for me? What advice would you have for them in thinking through that decision to do so or not?
The earlier you can learn as a young person the value of sacrifice and what it does to build character. There's way too many young people who think they can watch a couple of YouTube videos, identify with some group, and think that they have a voice or a power that matters. If you haven't done anything, mm-hmm. your voice doesn't matter. If you haven't sacrificed, and I'm not saying it has to be in the military, like I had this idea that you shouldn't be able to vote unless you've sacrificed 2 years to your country. And a lot of European, they have conscription, and I don't think everybody should be in the military, but it should be like 2 years in the military, 2 years in a Canadian Peace Corps, where you go overseas and you serve other human beings in some way or clean up garbage in the ocean, or 2 years in the Canada Corps, where you plant trees or you help rebuild First Nations water supplies. But unless you sacrifice 2 years, like I don't think you should have any business voting on public policy just, you know, because you think you're informed. But I don't know if that answers your question specifically.
It does.
If you're a young person and you're looking, there's a gap in your life. It's not filled by YouTube video games, Pornhub, and junk food, right? It's filled by you going out there and doing something dangerous or doing something that requires suffering. And too much of the young generation think that they don't have to suffer, but they still deserve all of the benefits of society. So go out there and dedicate yourself to something bigger than your ego. Come back, and it can be the military. A lot of men I talk to now, like we kind of, and women, we're doing more with women. They yearn for a gut check. In a world where you're constantly kind of pampered by messaging and compliments and trophies for everybody, deep down humans who are high performers want to know, can I do it? Mm-hmm. Can I survive a gut check? And my dream one day is to build a camp where I can take executives and young kids and give them like micro gut checks so that they can evolve as a human.
That's really cool. I like that. That's actually one of the reasons why I love hiring athletes because they have that discipline and like mini gut checks because they learn how to lose. Mm-hmm. I find they make the best like teammates in general.
So. Can I share a story with you about the military and athletes?
Yes, for sure.
And the U.S. military, I think is really relevant to what you said. The U.S. military did the most detailed study on leadership after World War II. It's the first time they had data collections, and because World War II was so long and so many units, they assessed the success rate of leaders. So junior officers, lieutenants, captains, majors, and even some colonels. And the number one factor that they found that resulted in combat leadership success, not peacetime leadership success, which is kind of corporate bag licking, right? But in combat, what inspired people to follow them was varsity athletic experience. And the reason they correlated it is that if you play on a varsity team and you're a captain, like you can't fake it. You're not there because your dad is rich, mm-hmm. right? You're not there because you're good looking. Like if you're leading a varsity team, you have to be a performer.
Right.
You have to set the example. And so what you said about varsity athletics really translated into combat success as a leader. And I think it translates into business success. Because
I couldn't agree more. Couldn't agree more. What's something that you're most proud of your tenure with the Canadian military?
Most proud of in the military. It's weird. I never thought about it that way. You know, I think it's just like some of the friendships I made from local populaces in combat theaters and my friends. Like my fondest memory is when we were deployed in Yugoslavia during the kind of Sarajevo, the hard part there. And just being with a band of brothers, it's nothing close to the movie Band of Brothers, because what those guys went through is just a whole other level. But the bonds you make when you're with people who are facing danger every day, it really transcends the kind of frivolous surface conversations we have every day. Like think your listeners can relate. How many times you have the same conversation every day with people who really don't care? Right. But if you're in a startup and you're sacrificing every day, and sleep, that's you make those bonds. And that's kind of my best memory, is being like with a bunch of 23 and 24 year olds, you know, who are in charge of 36 lives and just hoping to get out of it. But, you know, those quiet moments of, I don't know, you just appreciate life a lot more in those scenarios.
Wow. Love that. Yeah. Cause I feel like that's what builds bonds, going through hard times together. Mm-hmm. Just like it's human nature to just, you have a bond with someone when you sacrifice together, go through a hard time and come out the other end.
And so in today's business, like how do you build a business of a hardcore team when nobody will sacrifice or suffer before they put up a safe space card?
Yeah.
Or, you know, like, so how do you build something meaningful?
That's a great question. I think about that all the time. Hmm. You got any advice?
Well, you know, maybe we can build this leadership camp that I want to do one day, because I think you can do it in micro. It doesn't have to be the military, but it's like micro. I think you have to start micro, especially if you get kids who have come through schools where everybody gets a trophy, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And I think there has to be a way of filtering, because some people are still hungry for it.
I think I was just about to say that. I think there are still people that are hungry for it. And my mentor and our venture capital investor, Anthony Lacovera, he says that one of the best traits of a successful entrepreneur or someone who's successful in general is resilience. Mm-hmm. And it's like, are people born with resilience or is it developed over time? And I actually have this like dream one day where I want to create this like academy for entrepreneurs where
we should do some,
where I take them out of high school, like the people that are willing to grind. There's a lot, not most people are not, where I want to take like, kind of like, you know, like AC Milan or like Manchester United have academies where they like take kids from like Argentina or whatever, from 7 years old and train them to be like football superstars. For me, I wanted to like identify, do a psychological analysis on what makes likely the best entrepreneurs, try and recruit those people, put them into like a junior academy where it's not like university, where it's very like, not that, you know, university is what it is, but more like a strict like Navy SEALs kind of thing for entrepreneurs, you know?
Oh, that we could do that. Like I can even tell you on, can't talk about the specifics of some of these courses, but on one of the selection courses for special forces, it's interesting you say resilience. They try to test phobias and resilience, but there's one test where you go through like small metal tunnels in pitch dark and they kind of tell you the route, right? And you got to get to the end and then you got to come back. But you can't see, there's like a giant wall you can see is the hole. And so you got to crawl in, remember the route, and you don't know that the tunnels get narrower. So it starts off wide, it's pitch dark.
That would freak me out, right? That's for sure.
But the real rub is that as you're coming back, they actually have changed the tubes so that you think you know the way back, but as you've gone past, they've changed the route. And the amount of people who quit when they come to where it should be, right? And that they just want to get rid of quitters. But the people who pass the selection are the ones who get there and say, okay, wait a second, something's happened here. Do you panic? And when you're in a closed space, it shows like business people have to make decisions, you know, that are very intense and short thing. And all of a sudden something changes. It just teaches you, can you keep your head when the situations have changed? And they're assessing out resilience. And we could do something like that from an entrepreneurial perspective, is give them small party leadership tasks, or just make it so that no matter how bright you are and how good your grades were in your undergrad, right, you're going to come across a situation in business where it's not working out the way you want. Can you still fix it?
Yeah, exactly. I would love to explore that more off podcast.
Yeah, definitely. We'll do that.
Yeah. What do you think are three skills you developed in the armed forces that impacted you today, who you are today? And do you think you had those before you started, or were they developed during that phase of your life?
It's interesting because, you know, I was always hungry for challenge, right? Like as a young person doing stuff. So, but I think the skill I learned is, whatever you think your limit is, that's not it. And the limit that you give yourself, you know, and some of the people I work with in business, especially in the marketing world, you know, I just, it makes me laugh when they go, oh my God, I'm freezing. I'm like, you don't know what freezing is. Right. Or how many times a week they'll say I'm starving.
I was just thinking that one. Yeah.
Right. Like they're just words that kind of soothe the ego to say like, I need to pamper myself. But when you've gone to what you think is your limit and then you actually go double, right? And especially, I think that's what the running is too, right? Like when you do those runs and all of a sudden you stop, but when you're with a group and there's a sergeant screaming at you and like you kind of stop on that first week at kilometer 3 and you're like, I can't go anymore. But then you end up doing 6 kilometers.
Right.
You're like, I just did double from where I was prepared to stop.
Right.
And that's, and it teaches you to kind of push yourself further and actually encourage people to push themselves a little more.
Yeah. Love that. Cool. One question that I wanted to ask you was, you know, a lot of people have certain, points of view on the Canadian Armed Forces or like the Army in general. Yeah. What do you think something that more Canadians should know, about the Canadian Armed Forces that maybe they don't or have like some kind of paradigm about that's wrong?
I think understanding the history of the Canadian Armed Forces is amazing, what we did in the wars. And if people are interested in, you know, anecdotal evidence, when they study World War II, they kind of tried to identify the best countries at what they did. And I don't know if we chat about it at the dinner, but the best tactical leadership, hands down, German Army. Whether you like them or not, their officer corps were the best tacticians in the world, you know. And even the Israeli Army has studied them today, just because of how good their tactics were. And the Israeli Army probably has the best tacticians today. But the Germans in World War II had the best tacticians. The best political arm was England. So in terms of the population getting behind the Battle of Britain, those people were, they would fight to the last man, and Hitler knew that, and that's why he never invaded them. You know, a little bit different than the French, right? They knew that they would not ever surrender. The best logistics component, business model was the U.S., you know, kind of employing Taylorism and some of their, you know, their advanced technology. They were able to move more people and things faster than anybody in the history of the world. But what's relevant to Canadians and maybe your listeners is the best soldiers, privates and corporals, in terms of fighting, hands down, Canadians.
Why? What made that so?
A lot of them came from, Canada is a country that was, Canada was probably 10 times harder to settle than the United States. The United States has east-west rivers. Right, the United States has abundant food sources, and you know you can survive a winter by yourself. That's why the U.S. is very, because of climate, individual rights. You can kind of take your homestead and assert it. You can't go across northern Ontario, Winnipeg, Manitoba, and Saskatchewan as an individual. Right, and it actually influences politics a little bit. You had to cooperate with your community to survive the winter, but surviving a Saskatchewan winter and summer. You had to use guns. Like, we had tough MFs in Canada back in the settler days, to, you know. And I think people think we're all polite, but in order to go across Canada and survive in our climate, you had to be very tough and resilient. And so when we put those soldiers over in Europe fighting Europeans, the Germans terrified of Canadian soldiers, you know, just in terms of their toughness. So when you ask me, what do I think Canadians should know about Canada? We have a history of being hardcore warriors, right? And I think the problem today is, we're ruining our national defense framework and actually threatening Canadian security by imposing political correctness on an institution that cannot focus on identity. When you go into the military, you're stripped of your identity so you can be built back up into somebody who will sacrifice for the nation. But right now they have courses in the military teaching brand new recruits to fixate on their identity. And now that's nice in peacetime. And that's nice if the Trudeau government wants to show how DEY we are. Mm-hmm. But the second that unit gets into combat, like baristas do not do well in combat, right? And so I really am worried about the current state of the Canadian military because its senior leadership has been infected by what the government wants to do in terms of social, almost policy pawns, right? And we see it's a very disturbing thing, and we don't need to get into it.
Oh, well, actually, I'm going to come back to that in a little bit, actually, because I'm interested in your opinion on that. Mm-hmm. One last question I want to ask about, like, your experience in the, with the Canadian Army. Mm-hmm. If you don't mind sharing a story that you, or a moment in time that you had at when you were there, or in that environment that changed your perspective on either like human nature or the world that likely someone wouldn't have gotten if they weren't in the Army.
Right. I got it. So there was a zone of separation between the two warring factions for a while. And as Westerners, you know, we get our training. And so we went into the Balkans and I would go meet a local commander and be like, okay, we need to get a humanitarian convoy through there tomorrow. I would do this big explanation and the local commander would be going, yes, yes, right? And the next day we go there and they wouldn't let us through. And I'd come back and I'm like, you're fucking liars. Like, you told me you could be here. You're like, why aren't you? You're lying. Like, and it would just frustrate me, and especially Americans. And so then we would vilify these people and cast labels on them. And when I came, and it almost it probably cost a bunch of lives at different times, because it would escalate and there'd be like little skirmishes. And when I got back to Canada in the military, I decided to do a master's in conflict negotiation and culture. Mm-hmm. And I did my thesis on negotiating across cultures. And what I learned from that experience is that high context cultures, and I think it's really relevant in business, and low context cultures differ. Western society is low context culture, meaning we say what we mean. Mm. Time is money. Mm. Let's focus on the goals. High context culture means there's a lot of context to communications, right? And so
what's an example of a high context culture?
Southern Europe, Balkans, China. And this is why you hear, if you go into the Balkans or Afghanistan or the Middle East or even southern Spain or Italy, you don't talk business until you've socialized for 2 hours,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
right? Whereas with Westerners, it's like, let's get down to business. Time is money. I'm going to be straight. There's no context. What I'm saying is what I mean, mm-hmm. right? In a high context culture, what I learned is, and they're also called face-saving cultures, they had developed internal mechanisms to prevent conflict because honor meant so much in villages and families that you wouldn't say no to somebody. Because it's rude just to say no. So you would kind of have a conversation that would talk about a lot of things. And if you understood their culture, they said no to you. Mm. And they would say yes, which means, yes, I'm hearing you. Right? And this is what led to probably the deaths of many people in military, is because a Western culture, low context, would go up and hear a yes. And all they're saying is, I hear what you're saying. But we haven't, what they're saying is, we haven't developed a relationship in which I'm prepared to follow what you like. And so that's why I did my thesis on that, so that we could learn how to understand the cultures when we go into foreign theaters.
Very interesting. And do you think that is even in the way that we in Western culture communicate amongst each other, that happens in a way that's maybe less extreme?
Absolutely. No, and it's important to understand the cultural framework of communication. It happens in business when the U.S. would send a delegation to China, right, to try and negotiate a treaty. And all of the people going there on the U.S. delegation were concerned about their careers, about bringing back results, success, where the Chinese delegation, they were interested in the empire, and they're thinking 20 years down the road. Mm. And so the U.S. would often get their butts kissed, because they go over there, they think there was a reciprocal obligation. They give something, and the delegation would just nod. And then they would deliberately take the whole four-day diplomatic mission and treat them like gold for four whole days, not discuss anything. And then the last day before they get on the plane, they put a table there. And the Americans are so bent on bringing home some success that they would throw away the farm. So it is relevant to business negotiations.
Yeah, one of the things that I think is super interesting, even just from a business perspective, it's like the people in a multidisciplined team. You know, you got your engineers, you got your programmers, you got your analytical people, you have your business people, you have your creative types, mm-hmm. et cetera. You have your finance department. All of them look at the world in a very different way. And likely that's what made them go into that field or excel in that field. Mm-hmm. And being an entrepreneur or a manager or a leader, you need to understand how each of those mindsets communicate and work in order to have a cohesive team. And now from what you saw from worldwide perspectives, a lot of people wouldn't even believe probably the difference in culture. But even from a micro level on like an individual team, that's so prevalent. And that's been one of the things that I had to learn how to do, coming from like a finance background, where in my world in banking, everyone was very straight to the point. Don't waste somebody's time. Like, I wouldn't say, hey, Philip, do you have a minute?
Yeah.
Because that would be like, you just waste time. Just ask me.
Yeah, exactly.
That was my world. So then when I started working with creatives in like design and like branding that are a little bit of a more slow moving and sensitive type individuals, they like to communicate before jumping to like the point.
Interesting. I think in the last decade, the best personal development thing I got, I'm very skeptical of these personality tests and all those things that are out there. But when I did go to Schulich for my executive MBA, I think the only useful thing I got out of that was this one lady came in and did a, I can't remember what the test name is, but it's kind of a personality test that, but it gave colors and I was so skeptical. I was like, I don't even want to go to this thing. Like there's no way, even though I have a master's in culture, but it did really teach about the difference in terms of introverts and extroverts, you know, and the reds were, and it grouped our whole of 50 people into these kind of groups. So the reds are people who focus on achieving and objectives. The yellows are very social. The greens are feelers and the blues are analytical thinkers. And, you know, and I didn't think there was any scope to know it, but then I realized that when I was communicating to people on my team as a very strong red, an objective person, when you tell kind of like a blue something, they don't answer you right away and you think they don't care, but really they just want to go and think about it and come back with the right answer.
Which is frustrating for a red.
Yeah. Right. And then yellows are always the ones, first ones to put up their hand. They want to see, but they want to help, but people don't like them sometimes because they're too much in your face. And then the feelers are the ones who give you, they're watching everybody. They're your secret weapons because they can actually see what's happening when you're anyhow, I just found that was a very rewarding thing and I have my team do it. And now they know that if they want to get my attention, they got to speak to me in a certain way. And they also know, and I know now that their silence isn't disinterest. It's actually interest. But the one thing that the blues on my team or the greens were told is that if they want to get my attention in a meeting, put up your hand because I'm so busy talking and thinking and going here. But if they put up their hand, I'm like, okay, I'll stop. And I'll be like, okay. And then, you know, it's a nice way of having better communication.
I love that. Yeah. Okay, so let's switch gears a little bit here. You say that you wanted to change the way law is done. Can you talk to me a little bit more about that?
Well, that's where my business coach said, if you wanted to do, I said I wanted to make law into kind of an abundance environment, still focused on winning, but not the ego, and run it like a special forces unit where we don't have as hard timings where, you know, people are just expected to do it. And, you know, over years it's been extremely difficult to do because I think the wrong personality types for that environment are drawn to law. It's almost like the law firms have to be so dysfunctional because the people who go into it will only respond to it. Because if I get, you know, if you give people the leeway, if you say, okay, care, like they just don't respond to it. Like they're just so focused on metrics scoring internally. Right. And so, you know, I kind of concluded in the end that law firms operate like this because they have to, because of the people who go into it. But I pretty much had to let go 10 people to find one person who really wanted it. But when you find that one person, they're
golden. Amazing. Yeah. You said you, I saw on your website, it says that built around special forces principles.
Yeah.
Law firm built around special forces principles. What does that mean exactly?
You know, I wrote 13 laws. And I often ask people what they like, but, you know, I have one, like, we lift each other up. You know, we don't tolerate bullying, right? But also, you know, it's better to be feared than liked. You know, I think too many people want to be liked by their colleagues, you know, as opposed to be respected. You know, and you end up liking somebody you respect. I think if you try to be liked, you don't respect them, and it's hard to like somebody who you don't respect. And so we kind of built these principles of just we lift each other up is a foreign concept. You know, in a law firm where it's all
it's usually all about you,
and us versus them. Yeah, and so we had a policy, like if anybody in the firm or in even in the marketing company, if anybody ever says they have an emergency, the policy is everybody in the company who does not have an emergency makes themselves self-available. Right. And so you don't have these stovepiped, and it's really cool because now you can see someone in litigation is watching somebody over there, and it's amazing where the best solutions come from. You know, it can come from the cleaner. Like I've invited the cleaner, who's a wonderful lady, into our conference room to watch a trial that our firm is running. And she'll say, well that person should, and we're like, we all missed that. Like, you know, so I like that environment, but that doesn't exist in law where the lawyer is God. It's like the surgeon is God.
Right.
Don't question me. Just carry my bags. And it's not as successful as having a collaborative approach.
I agree. That's a really good principle that I read in Ray Dalio's book too, where it's like, it's not necessarily about like seniority, but who has the best idea wins and who's the most believable. And I believe that like tremendously, that it doesn't matter where you are in your career, a good idea is a good idea.
Yeah, you'll like this because even if you study like small special forces units of 6 or 8 people, there might be a captain or a lieutenant or a sergeant in charge of it. But when you get to the demolition phase of the operation, the corporal with the demolition experience now commands that, right? And when you get to the signals, and so being a leader is partly knowing when to suck back and let an expert do it as long as you focus on the mission.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. As I develop in my entrepreneurial career, my company's been around for just under 6 years now. And now as the company is growing, I have like more resources, where at the beginning phase, it was like everyone came to me to solve every problem. Mm. And I was like the best at everything.
Yeah.
And then as my company's been growing, I've been able to hire people that are better than me. And it's an interesting experience. Like, we just hired somebody and he's working with us now, and he's very good at what he does. And I was in a meeting and I'm like, hey, it's your first couple weeks. Just, this is usually my meeting to run. You know, you could just like chill mm-hmm. and like observe for the first couple weeks. And then week three came we were running the meeting, and he jumped in and he just started going. And I just sat back and I was like, this guy's better than me.
Yeah.
And this is an enlightening experience to know, like, I'm not the best at this anymore. And I'm just going to like sit back and like let him do what he's got to do.
Yeah. And they don't teach that in school. In terms of, school is all based on getting marks from profs who have the ability to give marks to you. And most of them want to have their butts kissed.
Right.
They want you to write what they like. You know, some of my daughters would just quit university because the profs aren't interested in a dialogue. It's like, just write what they want. But
yeah.
I think what you described there is the best people. And if your listeners look at them, the best leaders are the ones who hunger for smarter people to be around them. You know, the worst leaders are the egos who want to be surrounded by stupid people who just do what they want, because it's just a constant feeding of the ego, as opposed to what you did there, allow somebody to stretch their legs and grow into the spot. Like, that's what the top leaders do at your level.
I didn't learn that until I was probably 30, probably because maybe I didn't have to, or just came across me at the right time. But even in other companies, I see, like you were talking about the surgeon or the lawyer, where actually people, these types of leaders, they actually try to hire people that are not as good as them because they want that, like, whether it's for ego or like whatever their insecurities, they want to stay in that position of like being the all knowing, like God or whatever.
And that's what restricts corporations.
It restricts growth.
Yeah. But as an entrepreneur, it feeds growth.
Right.
In a corporation, it restricts growth.
Agreed. So at your stage of your career, you have offices in London, Calgary, you said?
Yep.
And what are you looking forward to next in your career? What fires you up for the future?
One thing I know I'm not going to do is go into politics, even though I've been asked. I just can't stand, you know, if there was a giant crisis, I could get into that type of leadership. But in a peacetime world where you have to like raise money and like, I can't do it. But like, I'd love to help come up with policies or create like a council of elite Canadians, because I'm not scared of the word elite. Like, when you earn your way into an elite unit, you realize that elite is fucking a million times better, right? And I want my organizations and my country to be led by elite people, because that's how you win and that's how you do good things. And, you know, and mediocrity is just killing our empire. You can't keep an empire going when everybody pretends that they're elite.
Hmm. Right? And why do you think that's like the case, that people don't? Doesn't everyone want to be on an elite team?
I think Canada is infected by a desire to say everybody is great, and so nobody is great.
Mm.
And so you look at the Toronto Pearson Airport, right? One of the biggest in the world. They hired a DEI person out of California who didn't have enough experience, but who fit the criteria. And that airport has been an absolute freaking disaster. And nobody has the courage to say it's because the CEO sucks. We didn't hire based on merit. Right? Nobody will fire, because you can't fire a minority who's a female and say that she was garbage, right? But think of the probably million human hours that have been wasted because of the ineffectiveness of a leadership Pearson. Like, think of every flight coming in and your luggage taking 90 minutes and delayed.
Pretty crazy. I never actually understood why that is the case. I just thought people, they always say it's because of COVID or like whatever. No, I don't know.
But add up all of the humans who are traveling, because there's not the courage to fire somebody who's not good. The other day she was doing a press conference saying how, you know, your organization is broken when everybody knows it's broken and the leader stands up and says, everything is amazing. And you can, I can send you the YouTube clip. It'd be amazing if you could put it on the podcast. She's speaking, saying how everything's amazing. And one of the reporters panned above her.
Yes, I saw that. And it's just like delayed, canceled,
right? And it's just, there's this disconnect in society where people can say everything is great because we've met hiring targets in terms of, you know, equality. But the organization is completely collapsing on itself, right? And so you have this dissonance between reality and what a few vocal people want to say is successful, you know, and I forget what the original question was, but I think I might've hit it somewhere.
You did. That'll be great, actually. So I'm going to transition a bit here as we wrap up in the next 10 minutes. Next thing I want to talk about is you, your branding, and also the marketing. So you are a content powerhouse on Instagram. Love your content. And I was talking about how most lawyers don't do this. Now, you probably weren't doing this forever. What started your journey in creating content, and like, why do you do it? What motivates you?
I think coming out of the military, like I wasn't scared of not being liked, and I always had an opinion, but I was proud that I was informed. Like, I will read everything on a topic that I can so that I can understand it and hopefully then use decades of life experience to be able to understand it. I'm trying to communicate some messages to people. You know, it's interesting. Like, I'll go on a golf course with successful people and I'll hear them just be kind of quite ignorant about issues, but certain. But they're good humans, right? And the certainty that's out there is actually an indication of lack of education on some things. So I try to present information that kind of pisses off the left and the right, because they both have intelligent things to say. And as long as they amplify each other, we're never going to have a dialogue.
I love that. So true.
You know, and there's just fucking great people on both sides, but you get too comfortable just hanging around in your echo chamber, thinking the world would just be fixed if everybody just adopted, blank. You know what I mean? This.
Yeah.
And it's not contextual, but I got into it actually because of Camille, because Camille and I were working in some other businesses in law and cannabis at one point. And when we started working together, she's like, your voice has to be heard, you know, and that's actually a theme of our company. Now, when we meet powerful business owners, it's like, look, your voice has to be heard. You're the brand, right? Like, and people need to get to know you in order to know they need you or to hire you. And she was the inspiration behind me actually getting in front of a camera more and talking, and it's done well.
And I love that, because that's what a podcast is, is for those that have been listening to my podcast. If you listen to like 5 to 10 episodes, you actually get to know me better than, or on your own time, better than most people would be able to, seeing me like once every couple months for like a dinner or coffee or, you know, or even more so like the people on my team. Like, I remember we have a teammate, his name's Nat Valentine, and he listened to one of the podcasts that I just released, came in the next day, and he's like, Anthony, I've been working with you for 1.5 years, but now I feel like I know you.
Oh, cool.
And it's a great way for leaders to get their message across without having to be confined by a 15-minute TV episode or a 1-minute Instagram reel, because the context is what makes everything.
Yeah, and it's a beacon for people who want to kind of come to your tribe, right? Because if they hear it, you know, and that's what I think hiring the wrong people or surrounding yourselves with people who pretend to be in your tribe is gets in the way of business success.
What's the name of your podcast if people want to like find you either on Spotify or whatever, or Instagram?
Well, there's Marketing Insights by Third Eye. That's the marketing one. And then the podcast was The Rogue Lawyer, and it's just my name, Philip Millar.
I love that. Yeah. In one of your posts recently, it seems like you're a pretty big critic of Trudeau. Tell me your thoughts on that. Like, how's he been doing in his tenure thus far? And do you think that he's going to win the next election? And why?
I had occasion to meet him before he ran for prime minister. And, you know, he was a very kind, gentle, and educated guy. Like, I had such high hopes for that guy. Like, he could explain quantum physics at a young age, right? And bench press. You know, more than, like, I like that, right? I didn't want old, stodgy people, but I feel he's, and because I know some of his advisors are Machiavellian, and it's a power struggle. He's not really leading anything. He's just on a public national apology tour. Like, he thinks politics is apologizing for everything the white man did, which is, you know, there's time for apologies, but that's not how you build a nation. If you build a nation, you have to be proud of where your nation came from. You have to recognize that the reason why everybody wants to come here is because we're better than them. Our society is better than them, right? And so tearing down our society because it gives voices to losers who haven't done anything. I'm just talking about mostly kind of like the trolls on Twitter, right? Like we've created a market of victimization, right? That's been commoditized, and it, you know, and he's just fallen right into it. He hasn't done, but if he had a policy that was powerful, like I'd support it. Like I want good policies for Canada. You know, I think he was a kind human who got kind of co-opted by the power hungry. The Liberals are Machiavellian bastards, right? I was talking to the convoy organizers, and whether you like them or not, I told them after, and they weren't really listening to me. I'm like, as soon as you raise some money, you could have bought Trudeau's top advisors. They're for sale, right? But instead, you just kind of promoted from within, and you didn't really have top, you know, you sent puppies to fight pit bulls. Like, and it's about power, but, you know, what he's done to the Canadian forces, what he's done doesn't reflect the kind of courage that I'd like to see. Like, it doesn't cost, you probably saw one of my videos where I confronted people in Starbucks, you know, or I've confronted law firms who put, our building sits on the traditional land of yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm like, okay, so how much rent are you paying? Right? Like, you're just putting it as a sig block to virtue signal that somehow you're a good human, but you're not fucking doing anything. If you're on somebody else's land, you should leave. Right? Or acknowledge the fact that if you conquer and take over land, it's yours. Just like the Comanche conquered the Apache and took their land, and the Iroquois conquered the Huron and took their land. Mm-hmm. Right? At some point, you have to have a stabilized society to build around. Right? And all of human history involves moving territories, right? It's not like out of the ground sprouted First Nations people who just, you know, were bequeathed it by a god. Like, they killed and conquered and stole and took from each other. And I just don't know how our society grows when we're trying to out-compete each other to criticize Canada, as opposed to focus on what is spectacular about this country, so that we can survive a few more decades for our kids.
I love that. Yeah, because like, Canada is such a great place to live. That's what, like, I like what you said about how people come here in droves for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, it's a great place, a lot of opportunity. We're accepting, we're open-minded. We have a lot of like public policy that takes care of people who don't have opportunities otherwise. We have great industries. Like,
it's the best place to be a woman or a minority in the world.
Yeah.
Maybe Scandinavia. But, mm-hmm. you know, best place to be in the world. Yeah. Like, you show me a country in Africa where it's better to go be a minority in that country.
And we
country.
Should lean into that more, because it's like, as Canadians, we're very, like, segregated, or, you know, like, we should be, like, Canada's one of the best countries that doesn't have, like, a identity of its own.
And that's what's the best part of this city, Toronto. Like, I love when I walk around Toronto. Like, I don't really see color. Like, I see humans.
Right.
Right? If you go down in the south, you see color so strong. But, you know, when I go into a cafe down here on King Street or on Richmond, and like, I'm not saying, oh my God, that's that type of person. That's that type of, you know, it's just cool humans. And that's what's so special about Canada. We need to keep promoting that. But everybody who comes here has to also be proud of being here, right? As opposed to just jumping in the tear down Canada game.
Love that. What are your thoughts on that new bill? I forget what it's called, Bill something, where it's like, now I can't look at news on Instagram. You heard about that?
Yeah. On one hand, I get, you know, when I look at arguments like this, I generally try to start by trying to create the best argument of the other side. And what's the best argument of the other side is we need to promote journalism. The issue I have is that journalism in Canada is dead. It's controlled by a couple of giant corporations. Right. Like I said earlier, those corporations are populated by leaders who are cowards and have been promoted based on compliance. And because when a corporation has monopoly, they don't really care about innovation because they just own the channels. So they can afford to like do things very ineffectively. So what that bill does is essentially allow money to go to other corporations from the social media corporations, right? But I would love to see in Canada us promote journalism again. Right? Independent, like Montreal should have 5 independent newspapers.
Right.
Toronto should have 8 independent newspapers all competing. You know, right now, like when you look at CTV, Global, CBC, they're all putting the same pablum out there. Nothing controversial, all just based, you know, like.
And all the good local news, like journalists or like news platforms are all being bought up by the big ones.
Well, they've all been bought up, right?
The Blog.to used to be a great little Toronto like publication, just got bought by Boomer Media.
Yeah, yeah. And think of who's going into journalism now. Like, I was talking to
Zoomer Media.
Yeah, Zoomer.
Yeah.
There's a great buddy of mine, Mike Vernon. He was a combat officer, and he's a journalist out west, and he teaches journalism at University of Calgary. And he's like, everybody coming in there are kind of, they consider themselves intellectual elites. Nobody wants to get their hands dirty. He goes, they don't know what journalism, like, we need to hire ex-cops to be journalism, ex-investigators. Like, you need to dig. And, you know, it used to be a blue-collar job. And now our journalism is just, it's empty. But anyhow.
We'll see how this plays out. It's a big thing for marketing, particularly.
Oh my God. Well, we went to this, I have no problem slamming lawyers. I have no problem slamming marketing. We went to the Morning Brew Conference in New York City. I wanted to vomit every 15 minutes.
Why?
But they were all corporate marketing people just falling all over themselves to Virtue Single. There was not one iota of intelligence coming out of any of them. Like, and I just thought to myself, these poor corporations are going to lose hundreds of millions of dollars because they're taking advice from fucking village idiots.
Do you think that's what happens when companies get so big?
Yeah, and this is a topic of a video Camille and I did the other day is, if you're a medium-sized company, meaning, you know, like under 50 million or 20 million, whatever, don't mimic what publicly traded corporations are doing, because publicly traded corporations are driven by ESG measures of success that don't apply to privately owned corporations. Mm-hmm. And the problem is in marketing, all the top marketing that you see are in these publicly traded corporations, right? Example, Bud Light, how to screw up a brand. But what happens is marketing agencies at a lower level serving private companies think that success is copying that, and they're actually destroying their clients' businesses by being politically correct. You have to raise your focus on your target audience and speak to your customer and not worry about being politically correct, because you'll go broke at that level. But it's something that I think has infected marketing, is they're trying to outcompete each other to show how virtuous they are, as opposed to how Machiavellian they should be, so their clients win.
Amazing. I'm going to ask you two last questions. Okay?
Got it.
Actually, three. So okay. First one is, what's something you're reading right now? What is it, and what's your biggest takeaway from it thus far?
Something I read recently. Like, I'm on Audible. Like, I think I got over 1,000 books on Audible. And like, to all the listeners, like, if you're driving and listening to bouncy music, that's good, but you should be cranking two books a week on when you're driving, on the subway, or working out.
You hear that, Valentina?
I hear you.
What book are you reading right now?
Your Next Five Moves.
By Patrick Bet-David. What's been your biggest takeaway thus far?
Okay, I can't think like that all this time.
I'll give you 10 seconds to come back.
That'll be the next book you have to read.
He makes me cry, actually. He tells stories of like his upbringing and how he got to where he is and his family and like what they went through, and I just like bawled to him.
It says something about you. Yeah. You're a very empathetic individual.
Yeah, I think Who Not How actually brought me back to solving some of the problems I had in my organization, right? Where I think like you, I want to fix everything. I want to do everything. Like, and a lot of people take advantage of that and be polite to you. And it made me reflect on how many people I'd hired or kept who were polite to me, but because I was busy would take advantage of me being busy, and I thought the smile and the politeness meant they were on my team, and really they were just working me because I was busy. And then you find that person who's quiet and who does the work, but it's not kissing your ass. You know, that's the who that you want.
How do you identify that? That's tough to identify, because one would think the polite people that kiss your ass are like,
you have to
the people in your band of brothers, and the people that are quiet just over there.
No, and this is where it was embarrassing to me. Because I know what a brother or a sister is in the context of that. But when you're busy, and this is what all entrepreneurs, when you're busy, you kind of give yourself an excuse to not pay attention. And, you know, if there's one quote I think a lot of the business people who are listening to this should get, was from a sergeant major named Wayne Bartlett, who is just, this is a guy who didn't have a university degree, but was one of the most respected leaders in the Canadian Airborne. And he said to me, "Sir, you can only expect what you inspect," right? And it's just, we get so busy that we don't go and just open that file and see if it's actually being done. You tell them what to do and they're all like, yeah, yeah, got it, sir. Great idea. Amazing. How's it going? Amazing. Right. And so then you're busy. And then in the end, when they end up leaving, nothing was done. So interesting. You can only expect what you inspect.
Love that. There's probably going to be a lot of people that listen to this podcast today and was like, this guy is the guy. I want to talk to him. What's the best way that someone could get in touch with you? And who do you look for? And like either people you mentor or people that you, interact with?
Well, you know, any of my websites, you know, whether it's Third Eye Insights or millarslaw.com or on any of my socials. But, you know, I'm hungry to work with people who care about something and who are top, like really
elite.
As difficult as it is to say, like, you know, competence matters. Like the horsepower in your brain matters and the strength of your character matters, right? And those type of people who want to do something, I love to work with. And I'll take calls from people who have mentorship questions, especially in law. So many lawyers, it has the lowest job satisfaction rate in Canada. Lower than telemarketers. It's because the system is broken and they don't have meaning. So you have to find meaning to be happy. But yeah, I'm happy to chat with people. But we're always looking for businesses that are doing something bold and need somebody who, if they don't want a yes man, they want somebody to come in who will like help them sort it out. And that's the beauty of you know, Camille's involvement, because her team, her understanding of branding and the digital sphere is second to none. And I consider myself one of the top strategists out there.
Last question. I ask this to every guest on the podcast. Mm-hmm. And it's been an interesting one to see different people's point of view on this. What's one piece of wisdom that you wish you knew much sooner?
You know, everybody would say focus, but I like the phrase bet big and be right. And so if you can go bankrupt on $1 million deal and you can go bankrupt on $100 million deal, why not bet big? Right? But you have to be prepared to go bankrupt if you're going to do something good. But there were opportunities that were big that I kind of said, I don't know. And I just kind of stayed with smaller opportunities that were marginally safer, but had nowhere near the uptick. And if I went back, I would have just gone all in on those big bets that I passed over.
I love that. That's something that I've been learning recently just from osmosis of the people that I surround myself around that are the successful ones. Mm-hmm. Is it's just as hard to do a $100 million deal as it is to do $1 million deal. So we might as well just shoot for those.
And don't let your listeners steal that, because that's my next book that's coming out, Bet Big and Be Right. So that's my title, guys. Don't steal it. But, you know, I'm happy to chat with you.
I love that.
Right on.
What a good conversation, Philip. I appreciate you greatly. We definitely could do like more of these episodes. So I'd love to do a follow-up one day.
For sure. I appreciate
you coming in.
We're going to do one, but I have a feeling in my gut, which is usually pretty good, that we're going to do in the next year some sort of leadership entrepreneur retreat where we teach a little resilience and leadership, because I have a location where I know we can do it and we can bring 20 to 30 people and inspire them to be better.
I love that. We're in.
All right, brother.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate you being on.
Nice.
Awesome. Valentina, until next time, this is What They Didn't Teach You in School. Take us out.